Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. This episode with Lori Nichol is really kind of special. And I say this in no small part because of the access that Lori has had, the perspective, the insight that she brings to this conversation. And it's without peer, without equal. And I say this because there are lots of leaders who have confidence, who have skills, who have opportunity. But Lori in particular has a perspective that I think is both powerful and unique. There are very few people who get to see our food system from the positions and the perspectives that Lori has. And this has afforded a kind of literacy, a kind of understanding that I think is quite unique. On the one hand, it's a high advanced literacy, a kind of intellectual understanding of not only where our food comes from, but more importantly, where it goes. But it's also a practical understanding. It's a familiarity with the infrastructure, both that Second Harvest is building, but also the infrastructure that we as a society need. Not just to make sure that we don't waste any food, but also to make sure that nobody goes hungry. And this puts Lori in a very unique position, both the ability to imagine a solution and the responsibility and capability to actually implement it. And that's where this particular conversation foreshadows, perhaps, a looming food security crisis, but more importantly, a food security strategy. That actually starts to look at not only reducing our food waste, but changing the way our entire food system works. And I think that's why this conversation is not just inspiring, but affords those of us listening to it a kind of knowledge, a kind of literacy that should be more widespread. Now, before we get into the episode, I do want to mention a new pilot project that we've launched here at The Future Herd. It's a website called commons.thefutureherd.ca, and you can find a link to it on our main website. And we're using it as a way to not only add audience interaction, but to try to find a new way of finding common ground, of looking for solutions, of talking about policy, of negotiating perceptions. So it's kind of the iteration of what might be the comment section or the forums. But we're going to focus on topics that are relevant to this podcast and relevant to our agri-food system, beginning with food security. So as you're listening to this podcast, open up our website, commons.thefutureherd.ca, and share your views on food security. All right, let's go listen to Lori. Welcome to The Future Herd. What does the future mean to you?
That's a really tough question right now that I honestly don't think I can answer it adequately. I am feeling very positive and hopeful, I'll tell you that, about a lot of things. So if I can just kind of focus on what does my future hold, not the global future, for Second Harvest, I mean, we're going to continue to try to eliminate and minimize food waste as much as possible across this country. And that is our goal, is to close our business in the next 20 years.
Right on. That's actually an excellent answer. It is meant to be a difficult question to kind of, you know, get us started in a manner that is very momentum building. But I also want to start by acknowledging an interview you recently did with our friends at CAPI, who are kind of a sibling organization of ours, in the sense that I want to build upon that and kind to encourage listeners to maybe even stop now, go listen to that episode and return. But, you know, there was one question, one insight I got from that interview that I wanted to throw at you right at the start before we talk about Second Harvest and the larger sectoral issues, which is, What is it about working in the service sector, whether in a restaurant or in a bar or a similar kind of client-facing experience? The leaders I've met who have that as kind of their lore, their origin story, they tend to have exceptional abilities that you don't always see in other leaders. So I'm curious if you could give me some insight into the value of having that as part of one's repertoire.
I really believe all people should work in service when they're younger. Like service being like retail or bars or, you know, anything that is public facing, because unless you do that, you have a very narrow scope of what the world is. But once you start doing that, you encounter so many personalities, so many different styles, and your job is to figure out how to make them happy. And that's it. And so it's like, I've come from the bar and restaurant industry, and that is a very, very fluid, very busy, very, you know, responsive, and all of it with a smile on your face, because, you know, you're working for tips. So your job is to make sure everybody's having the best experience ever. And I think that's just so good for life lessons of knowing, like, I've got just sat 12 tables and I'm still going to figure out how to get what they need in the best way possible. And often that's just about managing your personality to suit whoever you're dealing with. And that's just, I think everybody should have that skill to some extent. Because
it just helps. And I think there's an inherent empathy, a kind of human connection that, to your point, you by necessity have to develop and foster. And that kind of leads me to the first question I wanted to throw at you, which, again, it precludes us talking about the organizational stuff. But what are the through lines of our conversations around food security, and in particular food insecurity, that keeps coming up, is dignity and the role of dignity as a focus, as almost a design principle. And I bring it up now because I was thinking about that when you were talking about the value of being involved in the service industry, in that I think you kind of center that sense of dignity to the user experience, the customer experience. So I'd love, you know, to start off on that kind of blue sky, big picture sense of, given the incredible experience you've had, the journeys you've been able, the experiences, the people you've met in the sector, where do we stand when it comes to ensuring that dignity is central to the way in which we think of food, the way in which we think of hunger, and the way in which we think of food security as a whole?
I mean, I think most people that work in this sector, I'm going to say all people, because I've yet to come across anybody that isn't, comes from that space, right, of compassion and empathetic and not sympathetic, right? Like, if you're coming in sympathetically, that means you are have already positioned yourself as better than. And so I think the sector as a whole is, we're all just trying to do the right thing, because this can happen to everybody, and not everybody if you're in the top like 1% of billionaires. But you have no idea who is struggling with food insecurity right now. Like, you have no, everybody thinks they have this idea of, this is the person, it's in tent city, or it's the person asking for money on the street. It is not, or it's not even the person standing in the food bank, right? Like, one of the things that, I was food insecure, but my children are food insecure, and we never went to a food bank. That's not fair. I went once and they were wonderful, but I'm like, there was a space in my brain that I just couldn't, like, believe my life was here. Like, what has happened to my life? I never thought this would happen to me. And so I accessed food in a very different way through the child nutrition program and working in child nutrition. And I think by providing spaces where people can access food, where it's not an automatic, you're getting this, you're here because of the food, is really core to what our sector does, right? So we did a mapping a few years ago to find out, where is everybody accessing food across the country? We know that the Food Bank Network has about 5,500 organizations, but there's way more. 61,000 places, right? Like 61,000 places people are accessing food, and they might be coming in for addiction treatment or mental health treatment or after school programs or school. But the reason they're coming in is not food, even though often the reason they're coming is food, but it doesn't look like that. And I think that's really important, is meeting people where they are, because all that will happen is, if you don't, then they won't go. And then what, right? Like, we know that having access to healthy food is good for health. It's good for educational outcomes. It's important for economic stability. Like, it's not just giving someone food. There's a huge systemic piece behind it all that I think we lose sight of sometimes. So, I mean, that's just core to how I think charities in general operate. We are empathetic people. Often, a lot of us have been there. We understand it. And those who haven't really try hard to understand it by immersing themselves in those kind of situations. So, and I don't think that's just true for the charitable sector, to be fair. I think everybody is good. They start good. And stuff happens. And sometimes, you know, they stray. But I believe everybody has it in them to be compassionate and helpful and wonderful. And then, you know, just...
Well, and to your point, I would love to spend a bit of time unpacking those contact points, the diversity of places that people interact with these kinds of services, especially given Second Harvest's enabling role as infrastructure. But I want to tease out something you kind of implicitly inferred there, which is this sense of unity, which I've always, as I'm a relative newcomer to this sector in the sense that my background's kind of in technology, and there is a lot of implicit unity. You talked about it in terms of people really wanting to do this, the empathy that's there. But I also see unity around food waste and food waste diversion, in that I don't think there's anyone in the industry who are like, yeah, it's good and we should do nothing about it, right? And you could correct me if I'm wrong. Excellent. Because it strikes me that it's more an issue of what do we do and how do we handle it. But again, this is where your unique vantage point is able to correct my cliche. Where is that disunity now that you're bringing it up? But B, where is then that commonality when dealing with the issue of food waste and waste diversion?
So I will agree with you that nobody produces food, manufactures food, you know, sells food, buys food with the intent of wasting it. I 100% agree. That's nobody starting at that space. Having said that, we don't have $58 billion worth of avoidable food loss if people are actually unified and dealing with it. So, ta-da. I mean, to be fair, in 2019, when we first did the research, it was 58% of all food produced for Canadians, 58% was lost or wasted. That is a ridiculous number, but nobody was talking about it. Kind of the cost of doing business, and it just wasn't, there was no light on it. It just wasn't a thing. It was just, this is business and that's how business operates. So I will say in the last like 6 or 7 years, we're seeing a huge shift, right? Like people are thinking about it at home. Industry is thinking about it. We did the research again last year. 58% went down to 46.5%. Fantastic. Still a terrible number, really. Like it's almost half. What was concerning was there was more avoidable, which is edible stuff that we should all be eating. And so where the lack of unity is as a country, we don't have a national food waste strategy. Other countries do, and then they can tie all these things and you're watching their waste decrease. Well, you have to have a system in place. We do have a system in place. It's a bad system where we are great at producing food for Canadians. We are terrible at getting them to eat it. So what is that system that we have to implement across industry, across government, so that we're all doing harmonizing things, so we are measuring it? Like for me, it's kind of, it sounds simple, I know it's complicated, but it's not really. We all have to measure it the same way. There has to be a standardization of how we are managing food waste. So like first you have to measure it, set a goal, hit the goal. That would tremendously impact the amount of food that was being wasted. And so I am a vice chair of Canadian Standards Association. We do have a new standard that we've developed. I'm also the Canadian delegate for ISO. And so there's this new food waste management system that this was the final year. Now it's going to ISO for final approvals and all that. So that big food will pick up, right? Because they're going to tie it into their food safety. We made it very close to food safety. So it's not like implementing a brand new thing. Like there's edits to it. But that's good for global, big, not so good for mid, small. And that's what we're made up in Canada, a lot of mid small. So there has to be some thoughtful policy, and not regulations. I don't like regulations, but some kind of policy or framework that we're all working towards.
Right on. And I you raised a bunch of important points that I want to tease out of there. Perhaps most important is getting people to change their perception of what is okay to eat and changing their psychology around the food that's available, because that does strike me as both low-hanging fruit, but also a very big challenge when it comes to how the cultural dynamics of what people eat. But before we go there, still within this policy realm, I'm getting so excited listening to you, because I'm understanding the potential, and not just on the standards piece, which I agree with you wholeheartedly, but around the framework, around enabling both a kind of national strategy, but to your point, empowering the smaller actors, the smaller players, whether on the producer side or even on the food bank side. I'd love for you to spitball blue sky. Well, what are some initiatives, programs, if we had the resources, if you know, we had the right infrastructure in place beyond just what Second Harvest is doing, what would that look like? Like, what would the scenarios or the policies that you'd love to see happen? You know, give us some dreams here. Give us some targets to shoot for.
Sure. Well, first I'm going to separate two things, because supporting people with food is an outcome of managing food waste. That is what we're going to do with the food, is feed people. That does not in any way stop people from being food insecure systematically or sustainably. It is providing a food. So let's take those two apart. They're two very different things. And so for food security, we need to work on poverty reduction. How do we make sure people have enough money in their pockets? So that's wage policy and ODSP policy. And there's a lot to unpack there. Not my space. Like, food banks are doing great job at supporting people, but also doing great at advocating for those kind of policies, and we 100% support. So we need to separate these two as thinking, well, this will solve that. What we need to do is manage the food waste, minimize it. There's always going to be some, that's just a fact of life, but it doesn't have to be this amount. And ultimately, that's what I said earlier. I'm like, ultimately is to close Second Harvest, or maybe not close us, but to maybe change what we do, right? Like, we solve this problem, so what else are we going to do, kind of thing. That's really the goal. And so that means the first piece is always just, what's the framework? How do we get everybody on board? And that means you have to speak to industry. Like, industry has to be a big part of this conversation about what's already happening, what can happen. And I'm going to give you a really good example of that. Best before dates account for 23% of all avoidable food loss. And that's about $13 billion, which is a best before date. It's so misunderstood in this country, misunderstood in every country. So it's not even Canadian. Like, it's just misunderstood, except for we're behind in Canada because we have a best before date. Where other countries that have food waste strategies, they tie best before date to that food waste strategy. And so they'll have best before and use by. Best before is about peak freshness, use by, still not about safety, but like, it's just a better date. We know that a lot of food that we're throwing away, we would be able to eat in after the zombie apocalypse, right? Like, isn't that not just the Twinkies, right? It's the dried beans, it's the dried rice, it's the dried pasta, it's the dried, like, there's a lot of dried food, there's a lot of canned food that we're fine with. So I just, for everybody's edification, only 5 foods expire in Canada. Don't eat them after the expiry date. It's about the nutritional complement of that food. Baby formula, meal replacements, and protein bars. Your baby needs nutrients. If I need a meal replacement, I need the nutrients. If I'm running a race and I need that caloric intake to be what it is, I need that. 2 other ones, prescription only. Don't worry about it. You can't even buy it in a grocery store. 5 foods that expire. We have regulation around if a best before date is required on food that has a 90-day shelf life or less. Meat, dairy, you know, perishable foods. Fine. Leave those alone. I mean, I think they're a bit conservative, but peace, man. Then we have this huge amount of food that does not require a best before date. They're voluntary. They're incredibly conservative. Here's the good news. We're working with all the major retailers, Retail Council of Canada, with a number of manufacturers on how do we manage this better? Can we remove some? Like, we work with food scientists as well to say, okay, what is the outcome if you do this, right? Like, they're not on just on. Like, there are some reasons behind it, so I shouldn't be so cavalier with my language. But why? Like, is there some ingredient that you should just take out of it, right? Like, is salt should not, in my opinion, have a best before date, but I've been argued with because of an ingredient that they add. I'm like, well, I'll take it out. That's just me being silly. There's 11 of them, though, that they're like, okay, first it was like, let's take them off. And then we all got together and are like, okay, if we can't take them off, how do we evolve the system so at least it's more appropriate to the food? So I think that's where we're going to land. And I'm thrilled, right? Like, the first step is always the hardest and the best step because then at least you're moving in a direction. And so nobody's disagreeing with that. Like, major retail is all involved. Like, nobody, everybody wants to do this. So then the challenge becomes, okay, we're going to do this. Consumers are not going to understand this, and we're going to get a lot of complaints. Like, 100% agreed. We have really misled consumers in this country, and we assume that this best before date is only throwing things at the end of the line. It's not. It's right up the supply chain. Like, it's a manufacturer. We'll get called for 200 skids of tomatoes or tomato sauce or whatever. So that's where we lose most of our food. So then, okay, if all grocery can get involved and is interested, and they are, let's do a consumer campaign store level. It's one of the last places where everybody congregates, right? Like, if you're trying to get a message out, there's just way too many, there's too much content. It's hard to get a message out to the masses. Well, if you all run the same campaign in all the grocery stores and like online grocery shopping, then the message is there. You know, you have to do it for a couple of years for sure, but at least you're all kind of rowing in the same direction. I think doing that will have a tremendous impact because then what then you can move that needle along around best before date. So then I'm like, okay, so we haven't solved it, but we've definitely moved it in the right
I
direction.
suspect I'm going to be responding to a lot of your answers with right on, if only because this is the kind of stuff that I've been pining for quite some time. But let me throw you a kind of advanced follow-up there. It strikes me that the user literacy, the eater literacy, is a key linchpin here for any kind of success. How do we incentivize the private sector to take the lead on that? Because on the one hand, I can see the clear benefit to
They
them.
are.
Go
That's what
ahead.
I'm just like. That's what I'm saying. Industry and retail are taking the lead on this. I mean, Second Harvest started this campaign. Everybody got on board. So that's the beauty. You don't have to
And
incentivize
I
them.
mean,
They're
but give me an
already
example,
there.
because
So now it's a matter of how do you
I
operationalize?
say this only because I'm not seeing it, and I am, in my own modest way, a fairly attentive food researcher. Part of what you're describing, certainly from the standards level, I'm kind of assuming is happening behind the scenes, especially to your point about removing an extraneous ingredient in salt that it would radically extend the shelf life. But I'm still not seeing the kind of literacy campaigns that I think are necessary. And again, we could just stick to the best before stuff. Like you saying that there's
Right.
only five foods that true, like not only is that incredibly radical from where I'm coming from, but it's powerful. Like it's a reflection of the confidence you have in the food system and the knowledge that you've acquired as kind of part of your profession. You may take that for granted. But those of us here in the cheap seats, we're like, wow, preach, sister. Because it is radical compared to how the culture currently sees its food. But please correct me again if you think I'm wrong.
You're not wrong. I'm saying because it hasn't happened yet. What has happened is the conversations, to your point, behind the scenes are happening. And so that's huge movement than even 2 years ago, right? Or 3 years ago. That we are making a huge amount of progress. Now, to build out that campaign, it's probably going to take another year or two, to be fair. So, you know, when you're working with a huge number of organizations and industry, nothing really moves that fast. Because there's risk. And so we all have to mitigate whatever risks that we think that we have to manage. And so that's happening. So I'm just saying, like, yes, you don't see it yet, but it is happening behind the scenes. Like there will be, and that's best before dates only, to be fair. Expiry dates, I mean, that is, there has to be some kind of personal accountability, in my opinion, too, right? Like I get we're all busy and we don't know, but it's not like a hard Google search. So you, if it really matters to you, if it doesn't really matter to you, then, you know, have at it. But CFIA does a really good job of building awareness there, except for who's really following
Oh.
CFIA. So they had a great campaign. But again, I think that goes back to is where's the campaign
And
required? Right. And so I think part of that campaign would be these are the five people required.
unfortunately, and I say unfortunately partly because I'm a big believer in small d democracy, CFIA has been facing some legitimacy challenges, particularly from farmers around traceability issues. It's kind of compounded or complicated by conspiracy and disinformation stuff from social media. But you said something I think really interesting, and that's why I wanted to preface by saying I'm a fan of CFIA. I'm a fan of regulation. Is there a danger that we focus on safety at the expense of hunger? Is there a danger that, to your point about personal responsibility, rather than focusing on literacy and informing the public, we kind of err on the side of safe regulations that then inadvertently create food waste or perhaps disincentivize the reduction of waste? I'm kind of rambling as I try to form this question, but do you get where I'm trying to go with this?
I think so, but hey, man, we are known globally for the food, our safety. And so I'm not ever going to advocate not to have safe food, period, the end. And recognizing, yeah, there are often unintended outcomes for almost everything. And so instead of saying, let's, you know, move the safety for the benefit of this, no. You look at the system, where is the system breaking down? We're always going to make sure that that food is safe. That's one of the reasons I love this country, is because we have safe food. But if there's a system breakdown, let's fix that piece of it. Let's not just look at it all and say, well, because of this, this is happening. Well, it's a small part of the chain. Let's figure out what the small part of the chain is and fix it. And also, we export a lot of food. And it's really important for our economy to do that. So again, one of the reasons that we can do that is because we have very, very safe food and regulation in place to keep it safe. To be fair, I'm not on the ins and outs of what's happening with the farmers in CFIA right now. So I can't speak to it because I have no idea what you're talking about. And maybe there is some legitimacy to whatever that is. I don't know. But that means to me, just look deeper at the problem and see where you can mitigate it without creating more risk.
Let me try to create a compounded question here that connects a whole bunch of points that you've brought up in our conversation today. Sure. And let me start by saying, I think the most credible leaders are the ones who want to make themselves obsolete, who, you know, rather than seek power for power's sake, recognize that the organization they're building, the mandate they have, is designed to, you know, become obsolete, to solve the problem and evolve and become something else. But with that said, it strikes me we have a kind of paradox where, on the one hand, certainly the agriculture sector really wants to scale, really wants to focus on more exports. A big national policy is around more processing and increasing Canada's food processing capabilities. And it strikes me that if we focus on that growth without implementing the kind of strategy or framework that you're describing, we could actually make the conditions for food waste worse before we have an opportunity to actually try and make them better. What role then does an organization like Second Harvest, let alone the diverse smaller organization that are then connected to you to help distribute all this food, they play within this changing dynamic? And maybe this is a question of scarce resources or resource allocation, but it's also me looking to you as a leader saying, you know, what do we have to watch out when all this talk about growth happens to make sure that we don't lose sight of the need for this framework and the need to address a food waste?
Wow, you have just set me up for the best answer. Canada is working on a food security strategy right now. And pillars inside of that are food waste. So, like, this again is something that's happening. They understand the importance, and it's not just one ministry, even though a lot of it sits under ag. It's multiple ministries because they understand that there are other consequences to things. So this is already happening. So we should have a food waste strategy in the next couple of months, and food waste is a big part of it because they don't want to make those mistakes, right? But again, things are moving fast. I'm not going to disagree with that. Sometimes you're going to break things when you move fast, but at least you're moving and take the risk and move, because when you make the mistake, at least you made the mistake and you fix it, and then you're better for it in the end. So let's not look for perfect. Like, let's look for good. Let's look for good and don't let perfect be the enemy of progress?
And with that in mind, you know, sticking to the hypothetical and that, you know, neither of us know for certain what the details of this strategy will be, let alone how it's implemented. But give me an opportunity on a scenario level to imagine, you know, not in the utopian, but in the hopeful, optimistic side, how this will impact both kind of end users, but also those small organizations that you keep mentioning. And I say this selfishly because that's something I'm going to be pursuing in future episodes, is really trying to understand some of those kind of frontline, you know, where the contact points are. But give me your ideal scenario. Like, if everything worked out the way you wanted, what would that end user experience be so that we have a metric? We get a sense of where we should be going so that we don't lose sight of that potential target.
Sure. I mean, a lot of the times we just don't know what we don't know. And so, like, when I became CEO here, I'm like, we're a food waste organization. Let's shift the lens so it's food waste. How much food is being wasted in Canada? Nobody had done it. Nobody had measured it. Like, okay, well, let's measure it. Let's hire somebody and get this done. Same with the charities across the country. So now I'm like, you're right. We have a processing issue in this country. So what's the issue? Where are all the processors in the country? What are they processing? How much room do they have on the line? Like, let's figure that piece out. So again, we, Second Harvest, is doing that. We've commissioned Value Chain Management International, and we've got an advisory group of industry and government to figure out, okay, what does this actually look like? Like, you can't fix a system until you actually see the system. And so that's step one. Because I think for the end user, like, one of the challenges we have is we rescue big food and small food. So we have an app where it connects, say, all the Starbucks to a local charity, or all the retail, all the retails are on it, and then connect it to a local charity that has capacity to pick up smaller foods. But when you get a call, and we do get these quite often, we have 2 million pounds of potatoes. We have 4 million pounds of potatoes. We have 2 million pounds of this or that. But it's in its original form. So it's just pulled out of the ground, dirty. And it is, like, bigger than this building I'm in, right? Like, you just, it's huge amounts of potatoes. So now we have to think, not think, we actually have to do, okay, how do we make this in a format that charities can accept it? Because most charities are not big. They're not Second Harvest. Like, we're the only place that can, you can call us and we'll say, yeah, we'll take it and we'll figure it out. So then we have to figure it out with a lot of charities across the country. Like, do you even have dock? Do you have a cooler? Do you have, like, all these things? So this is all part of the app. So we have all this information, but then we have to figure out, okay, so now we have to get this washed and packed. Well, who can wash and pack it? We have places, but they're either full, or sometimes it's like the potato farm we got it from, it's not their facility, and so you can't use it. And there's a cost associated with all of this, right? So, I mean, you shouldn't say, oh, no, there is. There's a cost associated with everything. So that's why I'm like, that's why I'm looking at it. I'm like, okay, how do we make sure that when we collect all this food, we can get it and we can say yes to everything? And we've never said no. We'll always say yes. But as the bigger the food becomes, the more often it becomes, the more we have to figure out, it's not just logistics anymore. It's packing. It's transforming. How are we going to do that? Like, right in, I'm pointing to the warehouse in Toronto, but like, we're building in a microprocessor. So we can do that. So when we get a bunch of one product, we can clean it, cut it, flash freeze it, slow release it. Because that's another thing, right? The charitable sector can only accept so much of whatever one product is. I can only take so many cucumbers when there's a bunch of cucumbers, right? And that could be, you know, a million pounds of cucumbers. Well, you can't, there's not a lot you can do with cucumbers. It's not like you different than tomatoes, and, where you can take a lot more. So that is a problem in the country for not just charities, but for industry, like, commercialize, like, let's figure this out. Because it's not about the charity, in my opinion. It's about the commercialization of the sector. A lot, why are we sending all this food to the States to get processed to bring back? Because we need a stronger domestic supply chain. And
this is why I love speaking to leaders like yourself, because you've amassed a kind of literacy, a unique systemic literacy that very few people have. And again, to you, it's just kind of, oh yeah, this is how it works. But to me, my mind is blowing with all these ideas, because you kind of accomplished something that universities could not, that industries could not, which is engage in a research process to, your point, map out food waste across the country and then imagine the social and economic infrastructure to actually respond and process and allocate it. That kind of social or even like trans sector, because you're transcending individual sectors, that's the future of research, if you were asking me, and puts you as a leader in a very unique position because you can see this system and infrastructure in a way that neither the private sector nor the charitable sector nor the academic sector can, because you're kind of you're transcending all of them. So I say this as. I saw there's been a couple of stories, this is a quick tangent, then I'll come back. There was a couple of stories in rural Saskatchewan recently about food banks that had to limit how often people could use them. And in my head, I was trying to wonder why. And you kind of just gave me the answer that the issue is not food. It's the system that processes and moves and reclaims and distributes that food, which varies. Okay, please go ahead.
Because the food bank buys food. Right. So Second Harvest rescues food. All the food we get is rescued. So their issue is often money because they are bulk buying food. Like they rescue some, but that's not their core business model. And so when you're looking at a food bank that's slowing down, it's they don't have the resources to purchase. And I would argue,
as would I, and I guess that's why, because I have, like yourself, become aware of how much food is being wasted. My mind couldn't circle the loop. But again, you just said something that I didn't know. I just assumed that food banks were involved in waste diversion to Second Harvest, at least in the parts of the country that you're active and operating. I mean, there's the app as one thing, but then there's Second Harvest as more deeper infrastructure in Southern Ontario. Are you helping food banks kind of?
No, we're deep in infrastructure across the country. So we have the most sophisticated cold chain logistics system for this anywhere. And we support all the food banks. We give them.
And are they adapting? Are they taking advantage of that?
Some yes, and some no. I think they're trying to modernize their own systems. So, and it's the truth of like every business, every community, everything is different, right? So it's not as simple as here, take this and manage it. It's not. Like they have their own systems in place that they have to figure out how do they manage that. And I will say to some extent, again, it becomes a problem of one commodity at one time of the year, you can only take so much of it and allocate it out. So there is like the Second Harvest model is we'll give you food, all the food, like there's, and it's every, you know, we really focus on perishable and dairy and protein and produce because that's really the requirements of low-income people. But we can't say we're going to give you this and this and this every month or every week. We can't. Like, we can set you up so you know what's coming through the app and stuff. But when it's huge food like that, they're kind of, it's less, I shouldn't say less, it's regular. But it's not like I can say on Tuesday you're going to get. And so they have to supplement by purchasing. To be fair, because they are very much, this is what you're going to get. We're not. We're like, yeah, we can guarantee these kind of categories, but not necessarily.
Although doesn't that come back to the literacy piece in that it does seem absurd to me that we don't, by default, think of eating food that's in season and don't by default think of eating food like rice and beans, which, you know, are never going to spoil and are often quite affordable. I'm not at all saying, like, I'm a big proponent. One of our earlier episodes with Tresca Watson from the Mustard Seed Street Church in Victoria, we were talking about how, you know, food banks should have luxurious food as well. Like, it shouldn't just be about cheap food. It should be all the same food that everyone has access to, but we kind of have unrealistic expectations of what we can eat when we want as a society. I personally think that that actually contributes to the food waste issue, but I'm curious to come back to the cultural piece. And there's two sides to this. You know, we talked about the dignity and empathy kind of at the start of our conversation, but I think we're coming back into the culture around food waste, both on an awareness level that I think you and I both want more people to kind of be aware of the problem so that we can prioritize addressing it. But then there's my larger point about eating food that's in season and recognizing that when we do have a surplus of potatoes or a surplus of cucumbers, we should all be making cucumber salad and French fries to help deal with that. Or am I a little too crazy here?
No, there's so much. No, it's we're talking about millions of pounds of things. Like, so even you, my friend, could not eat all of this, right? Like, there's bumper crops, there's overproduction. So, like, it is just a humongous amount. And so that's not, it's like you'd be having potatoes every meal, like, and that's your whole meal. Like, you can't have that. You have to have a diversity of food. And I would say, you know, when I can speak to myself, I've been low income. I think I'm going to go back. We've industrialized a food system. So people don't understand what food is, period. Like, we took it out of schools. We've industrialized it through processing and, like, with the ingredient list and blah, blah, blah. And we watched what has happened to human beings as a result of that, which is terrible. So we need to unindustrialize our food system so we can get back to the roots. To your point, when I was growing up, I know I'm old, but still, we ate food that was in season because that's all that there was. We weren't bringing in a bunch of other food. But now we're like, okay, we have to bring in other food, and we do. We are a country of immigration. So we have to have food that is appropriate to the community you came from. That's not fair not to have that either. So there has to be a balancing of this. That is, yeah, we can't have strawberries in the middle of winter. Everybody let it go. And the truth is, you know, most people can't afford them anyway. So I think this, just by sheer economics, might weed itself out because people can't afford to buy them. And so, yeah, our whole food system is a mess. No, it's not. That's not true. Our whole food system is great. We have a great food system. There are problems within it, and there is a problem with food literacy in this country and in every other G7 country, all the Western country, where we have just lost sight of what food is. Like, it is here to ensure that we live. That's it. It shouldn't be a commodity. It shouldn't be for fun. It should be as a part of it, sure, have a bit of fun. But you have to understand, this is where your food comes from. I held up an apple in a school in Toronto, and I've said, where does this come from? And I, you know, the grocery store. And really, literally, like, no understanding. Where does milk come from? Grocery store. No, like, there's no connections to farm anymore. And I think that's a disservice we've done. Like, we're so urban centric that we've lost sight of the rural and what keeps us all fed. And we need to figure out how to connect those dots better for everybody. Because who doesn't love a farmer, man?
As an aside, farmers have a kind of political credibility that very few other members of society have, which is a whole other tangent. But the literacy piece for me is something I'm very passionate about. I think it's a crucial in an age of conspiracy and disinformation that we foster food literacy and we help people understand the larger health and nutritional elements there. You know, yay, high fiber. But there's something else I kind of wanted to dig in, and this is where I'm going to evoke the F word, because when it comes to food, it feels like the word free is kind of problematic. And I say this as someone who used to describe my religion as being all about the free lunch, that I would go anywhere to try to find a free lunch. But how do we balance, on the one hand, the very clear need that some food should be free with the other very clear need that some food should cost money so that we pay farmers, so that we pay processors, so that we incentivize grocery companies, like, all throughout the chain? It strikes me that, to your point, as we start looking at the contradictions, the paradoxes, the resilience, the amazing aspects of our food system, there is this kind of tension between the need to pay for food and the presence of free food, because there is free food around. We just don't always acknowledge it as such. I'm rambling. Bail me out here.
Okay. I'm trying to follow your train of thought. Like, free food because people are going to charities to get food, or free food just in general?
A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. But as a researcher, I just have to acknowledge that giving away food is central to our culture. Religions do it. Families do it. Food banks do it.
Sure. It builds community. Sure. So, okay. I'm going to draw a hard line on this. Food shouldn't be free unless it's required. Food, farmers need to be paid, people that work. Oh my God, like what is agriculture? How much of our economy? Food should not be free. People should be paid appropriately for the work that they do, period, like the end. Having said that, food becomes free in a church because it builds community. So it's not actually free. Someone bought it and people are potlucking, so people are paying for it. And then you have the whole charitable sector where food is free, but it's not free. Nothing's free in this world. And nor should it be. Like, yes, for sure, we can look at cost analogies and all that stuff, but I actually think our food is very cheap in this country, even though it keeps going up and up and up. I shouldn't say cheap. It's inexpensive. A lot of it can be inexpensive. But when you have nothing, it's huge, right? Like when your budget is taking up 40% is food, that's outrageous. That's less about food and more about the economy and people having the right jobs, having real jobs, jobs that pay properly. That's a poverty reduction issue. And we got a problem. Like we got a big problem where we're underpaying people, where there's too much gig work. There is a lot of problems, systemic problems in our labor force. That should be solved. That's different than food, right? Like nobody's going to say, you should give me a free car. Well, good luck. Like why? Someone built the car. Someone made the parts. So when you're looking inside of the system, I agree. Food should be free to people that can't afford it. And we should give it to them in a way that they can access it so they're not stigmatized. But that doesn't mean someone's not paying. It just means that individual is not paying. That family's not paying. And good. Excellent. Until we can get them in a place where they've got the jobs or the resources available to them that they can go grocery shopping. Nobody wants to access free food unless you're at unless it's like it's a festival or a party or church or whatever. But nobody's going, yeah, I want to go get this free food.
See, I got to disagree with that point.
You know, put my hand up.
I agree with everything you're saying about the need for labor to be valued. But I genuinely believe, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence on social media to support this, that people love to get food for free. It is a dopamine hit. But I agree entirely with your argument, but allow me to throw you the...
Okay, you just said your research is social media, so I already don't take you seriously.
As a leader in the center take a completely different position as me, an outcast on the periphery, and that is a fair difference. But allow me to throw a curveball. How does the food waste sector or the waste diversion sector address the issue of volunteer labor? Because I agree with you, all labor should be compensated. People should have well-paying jobs. But there is a lot of volunteer labor required to deal with the sector as it's currently configured. Granted, you've really inspired me today with the possibility of a food waste national strategy and the way in which it could really change the way we approach the current situation. But it strikes me when I've looked at my local food security organizations, their primary pain point is volunteer labor. How do we address that?
I agree with you 100%. I don't have volunteers. If I have a job that requires a full-time person, I hire the person and pay them properly. I agree with you 100%. Nobody should be doing things for free unless and except when they want to. Like I'm retired and I want to get out in the community and I have the wherewithal to do that. 100%. It's your time. You do what you want with it. Where I draw the line is when someone is low income, and they go into a place and they might get some free food and that's why they're volunteering. I really have a problem with that. Because if you can't afford to pay people to do the work, you wouldn't expect to go to Walmart and not have the staff paid or anywhere else. So I fundamentally have a problem with volunteer labor as a core. That is a whole industry problem in this industry, but it's not actually the industry. It's an industry problem, but it's a perception problem of everybody that thinks, well, if they work in charity, they shouldn't get paid. Why? Why is it more important to build a part than it is to feed somebody? That's an outrageous mindset. So that's something, you know, we're going to take years to systematically break out of their brains that, no, people in charity, this is like one of the most important jobs. This is the people that we're hiring, we are competing with corporations and private sector to get the best, because you want the best people so you can innovate, you can scale, you can do all the great things that industry does. So why would you expect volunteers to have the capacity, interest even? Why would you not pay for that skill, and pay for skill? So I agree with you, Jesse. I fundamentally disagree with volunteer labor as a backbone.
And while I can acknowledge that it will take a long time to kind of shift that psychology, any short-term solutions, suggestions, other than leading by example, which I suspect you're already doing?
Yeah. I think part of the problem is actually within the organizations themselves, where they, I don't know why, but I've worked with people where they don't pay themselves properly. And I'm like, well, if you don't pay yourself properly, if you don't value yourself enough, then that's going to trickle down. Like, you've got to, if you don't have the resources to do the job, then maybe you don't need to be in business, right? Like, you need the people to do the job. So just a lot of people with great ideas, and they mean well, and it's fantastic, but there's a lot of duplication too. I'm like, well, look what's happening over here. Why don't you connect with them? But yeah, I know it's the best idea you've ever had, except for these guys had it 30 years ago. So let's like that. I think there's a disconnect often in terms of really wonderfully minded people that really want to do the right thing, but don't actually look deep enough into see, am I fixing a problem? And is there somebody already doing it? Can I just attach myself to this versus starting something new? So there's a bit of work to be done. But again, it all comes back to like, value yourself, everybody. You guys are awesome. We're all awesome. And there's not enough jobs. Like, the labor and unemployment is going up, even though immigration and population is going down. Like, there's something wrong with our system. And so until we fix that, and that's a big fix, and I'm not leading that fix, that's huge. We're still going to have this unfortunate disconnect.
Although, to give you credit, I do kind of think you alluded to the fix. You're not in a position to apply the fix, but you alluded to the fix in the sense that we should be paying people more. Like, I think part of the reason why a lot of jobs are not filled is they're not offering a high enough wage to motivate people to apply for it. We're just about out of time. The two...
Yeah, maybe, except for unemployment.
No, go ahead.
Sorry. Like, you're right, we need to pay people more, but they're taking the jobs because they have no choice. And then they're stuck in this system of, I can't pay my rent and feed my kids, because they're stuck in this place where we don't pay people properly. That's not true for everybody, but there is a great deal of labor that is happening very undervalued, very undervalued.
And to your point,
sorry, I'll let you end, Jesse. I could go on.
Look, I'm tempted to take you up on that offer. My brain is still going nuts. And to your point, I think there are some AI developers who are being paid too much in terms of the larger market. I'm digressing. The second last question I ask every guest, is there anything that we haven't touched upon today that in our final moments you really think we should mention or get to?
You know, the first step is the best step. So see what you can do. For me, it's about food waste. So look in your fridge, understand your best before dates, and then share that information with your friends and family. So go to the Second Harvest website. We have best before dates, when your food is actually good too. If you're donating food as an industry, donate it here. And if you are an industry, if there's a lot of industry listening, please donate your surplus food to Second Harvest. We'll train you. We'll take it. We'll give you a tax receipt sometimes. We'll give you data. Like, we are your best spot to make sure your food gets into the mouths.
And let me reiterate that by saying the infrastructure that you guys are creating is absolutely unbelievable and invaluable. And I think the private sector benefits tremendously from both its existence and the kind of research and intelligence you guys have developed and are developing. Our last question is the shout out phase of our game show. Is there any other leaders that you think we should be paying attention to, that you want to shout out? It's meant to be kind of spontaneous. I'm trying to catch people by surprise. But when I say leader, who do you think of? Who's the folks that inspire you that you think the rest of us should be following as well?
I think one of the leaders for sure, and for me, has always been Catherine Parsonage. She is the CEO of Toronto Foundation for Student Success, and she has been working on child nutrition for her whole career. And because of her, not just her, obviously, we have finally gotten a federal national student nutrition program. And she's very innovative. She's very passionate. And I, like, when I was young, she was someone that really inspired me. I'm like, you can do anything. You can do anything. We can all do anything. And so she's the one I like the most. I shouldn't say like the most, but she's inspired me my whole life.
Right on, right on. Well, thank you, Lori. This has been, for me, mind-blowing. I know I'm going to probably spend the rest of the day trying to process some of the dots that you've connected and try to grasp a sense of our food system that you see with a really inspiring sense of courage. Because on the one hand, you acknowledge that there are some issues out there, but on the other hand, you see a path to a much healthier future. So, welcome to the future, Herd. We're definitely going to have you back. And thanks again for all the work that you do.
Thanks for having me. Hey, man, I'll be back anytime. I love talking about this, as you can tell.
This was another one of those episodes where my mind just kept being blown the entire time. It's not just trying to understand or grasp the scale of the food waste that we deal with, but also the sheer challenge of eating all the cucumbers that Lori cited, or dealing or thinking about the psychology of eaters as to what we choose and whether it's in season, let alone what I'm really left with, which is the research and intelligence capabilities that Second Harvest has developed. And I say this in part because AI research is something that's a passion of mine, something that we have and will talk about in episodes to come. But where we started this episode is kind of where we're ending this episode, which is the privileged perspective of the leader. That I think often leaders take for granted that what they see is special, that not everyone is able to see what they see, and that vision comes with a kind of responsibility. A responsibility not just for leadership, but to address the kind of problems that are only visible when you're in that position, when you have the privilege to look, to think, and to act. And that's where Lori, I think, really inspires not just a reassessment of food waste, but a reassessment of food security. And this will be a focus, I think, for our sector, certainly for this podcast moving forward. And that's where, again, I remind all of you to check out commons.thefutureherd.ca to share your perspective on food security. I kind of selfishly use this episode myself as a kind of research. Regular listeners know that I live to learn, and part of the purpose of this podcast for me is to continue my steep learning curve within the agri-food sector. But there are a lot of questions that Lori raised that I'm going to pose to future guests so that we are able to perhaps get a very unique perspective, not just on food security, but more importantly on food infrastructure. Because that's the takeaway that I have from today's episode, that we take for granted the infrastructure that delivers food from farm to plate, and maybe it should be open source. Maybe it should be more transparent. Maybe it should be something that, I don't know, you can go on a website and zoom in and zoom out and look at all the connections. I mean, shout out to Dana McCauley and CFIN, because they're kind of working on those tools. I'm thinking out loud. Until next time, thanks for tuning into the Future Herd. We'll hope to hear you or see you soon.